Welcome back to this week's Fear or Favour. So we're going to talk about a number of different subjects this week. First of all, we've covered it an awful lot, and we've now got an update. Nadir, no retrial for Maxwell.
Yes, we anticipated that. Their legal argument failed. They argued that juror number 50 should have recused themselves because he had a history of abuse himself. And the judge said, nope, I'm afraid that's not going to wash. He was in no way influenced by that. It was an administrative mistake and not sufficient to order a retrial. And so she will now proceed to sentencing. Obviously, the Maxwell family are up in arms and they're considering an appeal of the appeal. And that's the nature of justice, that people are entitled to appeal. But as it currently stands, Ghislaine Maxwell has now remains convicted and will be sentenced in due course.
Has she got another... I mean, I'm not quite sure what the process is in America, but has she exhausted the efforts now in terms of getting an appeal for that conviction?
She now needs to be sentenced, and then she can lodge a further appeal. But as far as the actual process of the trial has been concerned, the judges considered it and found that there was no reason to set aside the conviction. So the judge now will move to sentencing, and she will be sentenced. So this trial is over, but of course... there will be other potential appeals post-conviction, post-sentence. But they have to be on legal grounds, and we'll wait to see whether or not they will come. I imagine they will.
Yeah, I mean, she's going to appeal her sentence undoubtedly. I mean, she's going to get a significant
yes.
custodial sentence, and she's never going to get out of jail. That's going to be...
No, definitely not. I mean, this again, we've discussed before that obviously she can mitigate her sentence by giving information. So,
and she's obviously not doing that. She's obviously not doing that. So there is, it's really interesting. If you look at the psyche in terms of her as an individual, you know, you and I stand back from this and think, well, the easiest way is to do a bargain,
absolutely.
To do a deal, and actually reduces yours. But whatever the reason is, there's enough power over her to say, I'm going to take it all. I'm going to take all the rap, and I'm going to go to jail for the rest of my life. And I'm going to take with me all my secrets, because she has secrets, as undoubtedly she
was by his Epstein's side for a decade or more. And she will know stuff that nobody else knows. And as I said, as you said a moment ago, she's prepared to take those secrets with her to the grave at the moment. I mean, when the door slams on a 50-year sentence, people do tend to reconsider their life choices. So I'm not entirely sure that will remain the case, but certainly as it currently stands, she believes that she doesn't need to tell him anything.
Yeah, I mean, time spent behind bars when it's a final sentence. I mean, it's in the same as the UK, America, until such time as you get your full sentence, you do get different privileges.
That's exactly it. And she may well be moved to a maximum security from rather than the one that she's in currently. She may be taken to another part of the country, in fact. So there's all sorts of options that happen as a convicted prisoner, as opposed to one on remand. But as I said, time, maybe she'll just finally lose interest, or all those people who are, we imagine, are putting influence on her may withdraw their influence. She finally tells us what we need to know. And as we've said before, the victims need her to do this, because there are hundreds, potentially hundreds of victims who've not got justice, and potentially hundreds of perpetrators who've not been brought to justice. So she has enormous power in her hands, and I hope that she does it and uses it for the right reasons.
So I think probably exhausted in terms of her at the moment. We will talk again, I'm sure, about Maxwell when the sentencing comes. One area that has been asked quite a bit of us from our followers is to talk a little bit about harassment and stalking and about the impact of that. Social media is, in one way, it's a great tool. I mean, when I used to do quite a lot of talks, I don't do them now, to schools around social media. And one of the things that a number of teachers would often say to me is that, how do we stop these children going on the internet and doing, do we stop them entirely? Do we just block it? And, my response to that always is that it's about education. It's about talking to the young people and saying, look, these are where the risks come from. This is how you need to behave. But of course, the problem with social media is, by its very nature, is it allows anonymity.
Well, potentially, yeah.
You know, that whole process.
The keyboard warriors, we've referenced them. You've suffered from them. I've suffered from them. They feel emboldened by the online world. Before the online world, they would literally be standing outside your house, wouldn't they? And screaming and shouting at you wherever you may be, or following you down the street. Now they don't have to do any of that. They just simply log on. And the way the network, the platforms have enabled this is by, in effect, providing this purported anonymity. I mean, there isn't anonymity because the platform knows who they are, but the individual who suffers the plight of you know, the distress that's caused by online harms is second to none. You can't normally, Mark, you just close the door on the people that are trying to hurt you. But now we're all online, aren't we? Digital, in some way or other, and we can't close the door on them. And they just infect our lives. They infect our children's lives. You know, I used to be more concerned. Well, I still am more concerned about how they feel about things that are written about me than myself. I feel able to deal with it. And my resilience comes from my life, I guess. But why should they have to see what people are saying about Dad?
And I think that's absolutely true. I remember years ago. My daughter, my middle daughter, she was about 10 or 11 at school. And she came home one day very upset and very sad. And the school had phoned up and spoke to my ex-wife and said to her, actually, there is a problem because this afternoon she was on the computer and she was looking for, searching her name. Dad's name came up and it showed a picture of him with a noose around his neck being hung. And that really upset her. And I remember sitting down and talking to the kids and said to them, look, you know, there are some really sad people online, unfortunately, who do and say horrible things. And I remember another occasion where this really nasty paedophile who was a school teacher who decided that he was going to start to attack me. But he made it very personal because he said, you know, I know where your children go to school, you know, from this convicted paedophile. And I think the problem is these people do at times become quite obsessed. And in order to attack us, you, me, they look for other opportunities, don't they? And that means those people who
absolutely
are,
and even if they don't find somebody, they assume that we will have a loved one somewhere, and they will, as you say, the images that you just described and many more that I've experienced myself are frightening, because particularly children, they don't understand that it doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to be hanged, but you know, the next question that my children always asked me was, why are they picking on you, Dad? Why? You know, you've done everything right. You're a police officer. You've brought people to justice. I've brought people to justice. Why are they having a go at you when you're doing the right thing? And that, I can't answer that question, to be honest. That's the one I've struggled with.
No.
Because I can understand why. Well, not understand, but I can get a sense that, you know, if you're attacking somebody who's been really nasty. So if you want to say something about President Putin or something, good luck to you. I'm highly supportive of that. But at the same time, you know, if you want to say something about somebody who's giving their life to charity or to justice or something, that's a completely different kettle of fish, isn't it? And of course, the bots come into play here. We mustn't lose sight of the fact the number of times I've been attacked by somebody with zero followers who's just been set up a minute and 2 minutes beforehand.
Yeah.
But they pile on you. You know, I don't know how they do this. I'm not techie enough. But, you know, thousands of bots suddenly attack you and you end up thinking, you know, you literally feel you're under attack.
And I think what's sad about all of this is these very people, you know, I call them the Green Ink Brigade. You know, they sit at home and they become consumed by you. But the reality is, and there's a phrase or a rhyme, which is sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. I mean, that's utter rubbish because words really hurt. And, you know, and I know you, Nazir, well enough that, you know, these things do impact. Yes, of course, we've now become much more tolerant and understanding of it and it affects us less, but we still get hurt by those people who do those things. It still affects us and we still are aware of it. And I just, I always say to people, you know, treat others as you would treat your family, your loved ones.
You're absolutely spot on. Of course words hurt. That's why people use them, you know? And very often the words that they use are words that you yourself wouldn't use about yourself or about anybody. And I think that, you know, how many suicides have I come across or you come across, Mark, where they've written down X said this, Y said that, Z said this, and because of this, I feel I can't live anymore. You know, so those words, they didn't do anything violent towards them. Those words destroyed that life. And I think, you know, when we talk about stalking and harassment, just from a legalistic point of view, neither of those terms are properly defined in British law. They give lots of examples. So harassment is more than one incident targeted at you, which causes you alarm and distress. So it can't be just one event. So if somebody says something at you, that's not harassment. That's just a one-off and potentially a public order offence. But if they carry on doing it on more than one occasion, that amounts to harassment. Stalking is much more fixated on a particular individual. And stalking is a relatively new concept as far as British law is concerned. It was only brought in 10 years ago. And it was brought in because I think the authorities, generally police included, didn't really appreciate the impact that harassment stroke stalking has on people. You know, you are locked away. I know some phenomenal people. Claire Waxman, you may know. Claire is the Victims Commissioner for London. And for nearly 20 years, she was being targeted by her ex-husband, or not even ex-husband, some guy, let me be accurate, who literally destroyed her life, or tried to destroy her life. And she and others came to see me about 20 years ago and said, look, prosecutors don't get the impact. You deal with it as if it's sticks and stones. You deal with it as if it's words. You don't appreciate that I have to, I feel every time my child goes to school, I feel like I'm scared as whether that child will come back. Mm. Every time I walk out around the corner, or every time I'm in a club or a bar or a restaurant or an office, I feel that person might be outside. They literally become prisoners. That's why these crimes are so important that we do them properly and prosecute them properly.
And of course, social media has changed that. So you go back to the scenario where, in order to harass somebody or to stalk them, you there would be a physical presence. You know, you'd turn up at their address, or you'd put something through the post to them, you'd send them that. Of course, now so much of that has moved online. And I think one of the things, I always found it fascinating, when I did this program, ITV, we embedded ourselves with New Scotland Yard's paedophile unit for a year. And during time with working for them, one of the things that shocked me, and when I was in the police, we didn't have the technology, that was that they were still using computers, but without internet access. And that was still prevalent until very recently. In fact, some forces still have that issue. So in other words, finding information out, doing those inquiries, they couldn't do it because they didn't have access to the internet, which is absolutely mad. And I think even now, when I talk to police officers, you know, I was involved in a harassment case against an individual, which will come to court next year. But one of the things that was interesting when doing that was just looking at the sheer scale of these people, and actually the police officers, by and large, really struggling to understand how social media works, how these items are posted. And so there's a big learning curve. And I think that reflects itself, because ultimately the Crown Prosecution Service can only prosecute on the evidence that's given to them. And if, of course, the police aren't in a position where they've collected that evidence because they don't necessarily know how to do it, you're not on 100%. A starter, are you?
And, of course, criminals, as we know, are sometimes even cleverer than anybody else that we know. I mean, they completely, utterly live their lives fixated on a particular individual. So, and they will therefore use every mechanism. You close down one platform, they follow you on another platform. You close down one website, they follow you on another website. They will find every mechanism. You try and make sure that your address is not published. So you go to the voters roll, electoral roll, and say, please don't put my address up there. They'll find another mechanism by which they go to your office. They follow you from your office. They find out what car you're driving. They go through DVLA. People often innocently provide this information.
Yes.
I think it needs to be said, people need to be a bit more mindful as to why somebody is asking. Another example, a completely different sphere really, was very often you'll get a missing notice. This woman is missing. Please help her family find her. And I've come across many instances where she's deliberately gone missing because she's scared of her own family. And the family go to the police, in effect, to try and use the police to identify, yeah. find this person that has left the family. And again, the authorities don't appreciate often that information that's being sought, either identity or the location of somebody, isn't a good thing where they are trying to rebuild a relationship or find somebody who's in danger or harm. They're actually simply focusing on them in order to trap them, catch them, and bring them back within their control. And so you need to think, when somebody asks you, does this person shop here? Does this person go there? Whatever it may be, does this person attend this particular venue or this particular office? Don't give out that information without checking potentially with the person who it is that they're asking about.
With the person. No, that's very, very fair. The other thing that's interesting, and I think has definitely increased, is the element of libel certainly online, where you get social media individuals posting stuff. Now, some of these people have got no followers anyway, or they've got three or four followers. So, that libel's not being heard by many people. There are others, and of course, high-profile cases, Katie Hopkins and others, where obviously there's been very successful prosecution against them. And I just think that the whole platform, the problem, of course, with social media is that it's an instant reaction to something. And you instantly put something up, and then sometimes you may think afterwards, actually, do you know what? I don't want to put that up. But of course, the reality is that
it stays up there for life because people take a screenshot,
copy it,
or they retweet it, or whatever it is. There's a particular website that basically captures everything a member of parliament says. So members of parliament very often, when they're drunk, will put something up there and regret it half a second later. Unfortunately, this particular website is just grabbing everything that they say at every single occasion. And so, it will carry on having a life, even though you think you've deleted it. The reality, of course, is, don't tweet when you're drunk is a simple answer, and also think twice. I always, don't know about you, I always put stuff in draft form before I publish it, so it gives me time to think about it before I decide, and also be more circumspect about what you are going to say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think people, people often shoot from the hip, don't they? And then there's a reaction afterwards to think to self, actually, do you know what, is that the right thing? I mean, how many times have people, and I've done it myself, and I'm sure you've done it, is I've written an email and sent it, but now if I am annoyed, and I don't really get that now, but if I am annoyed at something and I need to send an email, I literally won't send it. I will sit on it till the next day.
We've all done it, and of course add to that the predictive texting or predictive stuff. Number of times that Nazir has turned out to be nasty, so I've put an email together and it's yours nasty, and I think we've got to be, this is the world we're in now. It's not going to go back. We can't do like Canute-like thing and say to the waves, don't come in. The world is now all digital. So we need to educate ourselves, and particularly our children, about how they deal with, respond with these things. Never, never do knee-jerk. Never, never always think about what it is you're going to put out there. If you're actually thinking this is something I shouldn't be putting out there, don't put it out there.
Because the chances are it is.
Exactly. You're already reflecting on how it'll be perceived. And I think and even likes and retweets, people seem to forget actually that a like, because there isn't a dislike button. Although Elon Musk, who's now taken over 9% of Twitter, might bring that in. But the idea of liking somebody saying, I hate this person, that might not necessarily think what you think it does. So people need to be, as I say, educate themselves, get educated, educate your children, keep yourself safe.
So another area to chat about is contempt of court. This has come up quite a bit recently, certainly in relation to Wayne Cousins and the fact that court case was going ahead. And it tends to come to fruition when you've got a high-profile case. And, of course, public, as a result of that, then get very emotive.
Very little understood. And particularly now, again, we're linking it to the last conversation we just had. People put stuff online. People search online. For example, if you're a member of a jury, And you are dealing with a case involving R versus Mark Williams Thomas, and the evidence is presented before the court. That is all you should be looking at, the evidence prepared before the court. If they go home while the trial is going on and go on Facebook or go on Twitter or go on some other platform to look up stuff about Mark Williams Thomas and then go back into the jury room, do they appreciate they're committing a crime? Potentially they are damaging, prejudicing that case. The case will have to be stopped. They've committed contempt, and they can potentially go to prison for that. So, people need to realize, I think, again, it goes back to the point about education. There are also differences. Invariably, when somebody has been arrested, stroke charged, usually on charge, reporting restrictions come in. So we've spoken before that if you are a victim of a sexual offence, you have lifelong anonymity until such time as you, and only you, decide to give it up. You can't, as people have done, start putting, when a particular high-profile individual has been arrested, for example, they all say, oh, this is X, this is Y, making this complaint. By doing so, you are committing a crime. And you need to recognize that. Additionally, when a case has been charged and awaits trial, you cannot rehearse the evidence in public or online. You can't go and say, the only place where that evidence will be heard, can be heard, is the courtroom. So again, you are breaching the reporting restrictions. You can be pulled before the court, arrested by the police, taken to the courtroom where the judge potentially could sentence you. There was a case only in the last few days, actually, that was published, which is not a criminal case, but it was but relevant, a family case it was, where, and this is another aspect of it, because of COVID, and it was being streamed. Again, you as a member of the party to the proceedings can watch and can listen. You cannot record. And they were recording and then putting it on YouTube. And you know what? 8 years in prison.
Is it? They've got it, really?
Yeah. God. Right? So can I remind everybody, let's do that again. 8 years in prison. The 1925 Contempt of Court Act, it's established for 100 years or more. You cannot record proceedings. You can't, however they've been relayed, either in person, in the courtroom, or online, you cannot record them and then publish them. And I think people just don't get that.
No. It's quite interesting, actually, if you look at the levels of sentencing in relation to contempt of court, they are always very severe. And actually, if you compare them to perhaps other cases of criminality, you could look at it and go, well, hang on a minute, why is someone getting such a strong sentence for that when they've compared rape to rape or something like that? And I think sometimes it's unhealthy to make those comparisons. But what it is about, it's about undermining the criminal
deterrence.
Justice system.
Sentence is to deter others from doing what that particular individual does. As you say, undermining our justice system. I personally believe we should be live streaming our cases.
Why do you think that's not happened? I mean, we've got the appeal court where there has been quite a lot of television around, but it's been absolutely resisted by the judiciary.
Yeah, to have and lawyers generally. They often use the excuse, and it is only an excuse, that victims, vulnerable witnesses. But you can find, you can screens, you can do all sorts of things to prevent their identities being disclosed or for their evidence to be somehow changed by the fact that it's being live streamed. That's one issue they have, is that it'll change the dynamic of a courtroom, that people will play to the audience. I get that, but we can deal with that. And look at what happens in Parliament, for crying out loud. We've been putting that out for 30 years, and they all do that. We can challenge that, we can deal with that. I think, I'll be honest with you, I think it's because they don't want to shine a light on what goes on in that courtroom. Justice in this country is slow. Justice in this country, if you went into a courtroom, I don't know, sadly, many courtrooms around this country, apart from the massive delays that are currently in place, you'll see a court that starts at 10:30, messes about for a couple of hours, has a very long lunch break, has a couple of hours of legal argument,
and finishes by 4:30.
And then people, I don't think the public they don't want the public to know that's how it operates. My personal view is that by shining a light on this, it'll change. Can you think of anything? I have this conversation with others. Can you think of any profession where we haven't yet allowed cameras in? You know, the doctors, you watch surgery, vets, you can watch surgery, police officers, you can watch them on duty, bin men, you can watch them on duty, or bin women or whatever. But for some reason, this is the one area, even Parliament, this is the one area where they will not allow cameras in. And I think it's because they want to preserve the status quo.
Yeah, and I can see that because, having been a police officer, I mean, I remember certainly in my first 5-6 years, the amount of time I would spend at court, particularly magistrates' court, going up and giving evidence in relation to that. Now, that has eased massively. Police officers are not now required to give evidence in court in any way near like they used to be able to. Used to have the requirements. But I'm still amazed, and I still end up going to court with cases that we cover. And I'm still, it always amazes me of the just sheer timekeeping within the court process and how utterly incompetent it is. I mean, here's a court that doesn't sit mostly before 10:30. When it does sit, you have arguments, etc., which will run probably till 12:30 or 1. But very often, there will be a break in between because somebody wants to go to the toilet or they want to have a discussion themselves. Then you have an hours-long lunch break. Then there'll be an early break about 3 o'clock for a cup of tea. And then you might run through till 4:30. And within this, there will also be other breaks because the legal teams will want for... that's why these trials just take so... I mean, who starts work at 10:30 in the morning?
I'll play devil's advocate 9 o'clock. Here. They will say they need the time in the morning to take instructions from their client and talk to their witnesses. And one of the problems there is the prison don't bring the remand prisoners early enough. You know, they wake them up at 7:30, 8 o'clock, whatever it is. They don't get them to the courtroom till 9:30. So it's a whole system issue. 20 years ago, the government of the time piloted night courts. I don't know if you remember.
Yes. Well, they did night courts, particularly around the time. Do you remember all the riots?
That worked really well because it was very time-focused, and I take responsibility for that, by the way. But before that, 10 years before that, a minister went to America and said, oh, this night courts looks really good, and came back and piloted it. And I was put in charge of implementing this pilot at Bow Street Magistrates Court, which is doesn't exist anymore, but it's in central London. And I'm not joking, it was everybody apart from me wanted it to fail. they brought in all these rules, and one of the rules was that no defendant can be dealt with, who can be processed if they've been arrested after midnight. Right, which is fine. We could deal with that. Then they said, they deliberately chose a central London court, which caused the problem. Let me give you the problem. Let's say you've been arrested for robbery, and you appear at court at midnight, and you're dealt with, and we decide to bail you at 1 a.m. What do we do? We throw you back out into Covent Garden half past 1 in the morning, with the potential then you might commit other robberies. Then we have this problem with the prison service saying we don't allow anybody into the prison after 9, 10 p.m. So what are we supposed to do with these people that we decided to remain in custody? The whole system conspired, I'm afraid to say, to enable that project to fail. But 24-hour justice, we need 24-hour justice, and I'll tell you why. Well, we know why. The backlog is ridiculous. 4 or 5 years it takes now for a trial in some cases, from investigation and charge. So in order to speed things up, any other business, any other industry would work harder. You have to pay for it, by the way. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be paying defense lawyers for working through the night, etc., or prosecutors, or police officers for that matter, or court staff. But how we tackle the backlog is by going full on, really putting an emergency response in place. And I don't see anything of that nature. But the broader point, which is where we came into this conversation, is that the system doesn't want live screening. And so despite my best efforts, your best efforts, and everybody's best efforts, I can't see it happening unless a minister, or particularly a justice minister, says, right, it's going to happen, and we're going to do it, and then resources it accordingly.
I think there's a very interesting when we initially started talking in terms of contempt of court, anonymity, and many people will know the case of James Bulger, who was murdered, the two-year-old boy that was murdered in Merseyside. As a result of that, there was anonymity given to offenders, to Robert Thompson and John Venables. And since that time, that anonymity's remained in place. But there was a situation where one of those two was involved in
further offences.
And I was given notice of this. Someone said to me, this person, it's him, and he is currently on a dating site trying to get into contact with single mums. I looked at it and thought, well, is it? Are we sure that's the right person? Anyway, I did some background work and established it clearly was him. I remember speaking to the police, and the police said, could we come down and see you? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So they came down and saw me. I gave them all the information. We did an article about it because it was really important that it didn't get covered up and that it was in the public domain. And I remember saying to the officers, so am I right? Is it him? And the officers said to me, we can't tell you that it's him because he's anonymous. I said, all right. I said, well, I'll work on the basis that you've come all the way from Merseyside to see me in Surrey, that it's him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of people don't understand why that's necessary. And it's necessary to, particularly when a child, particularly when somebody commits a crime as a child, because the Venables and Thompson did. It was the most horrific crime.
Horrific.
But they still committed the crime as a child, and therefore the law says that they should be able to rehabilitate themselves. And that means that you give them anonymity for the rest of their lives. And that anonymity, it literally is that.
What do you think about that, though, Nazir? So somebody, do you think there has to be a point to which two strikes or whatever strikes is out? So I totally understand why anonymity was given to them. You know, Mary Bell, there's other people who've had anonymity given to them. I totally understand that. But do you lose it? Is there not a point to which if you commit criminal offences to the degree that one of them did, you lose it?
I mean, not for road traffic or something relatively less serious, but a serious offence of the type that you mentioned, my personal view is that you've given that opportunity, you've lost it. I don't see any logic in why you continue it. You know, the point of it, apparently, is to enable the offender to rehabilitate themselves. Now, if they've committed another offence, well, they haven't rehabilitated themselves, have they? And so why then? And by the way, anonymity and all the bits around it is very expensive public money. So the public, you balance the impact on the public, the impact on public justice. And my personal view is that if they commit a serious offence, then that's the end of it. They've had the opportunity, they failed to do that.
Yeah, because that whole very nature of giving them the protection is to protect them. But when they've turned it tables around and continue to commit further offences, we have to protect the public. 100%.
And they can't do that if you don't know who that person you're sitting next to is. If they've reoffended, that's the important thing. If they've reoffended, my personal view is you lose your anonymity.
Whilst we're talking about that, what do you think about the age of criminal responsibility?
lots of times. In this country, it's 10. In some countries, the Netherlands, I think it's 12. And the point being that you cannot commit a crime. You cannot be guilty of a crime. You can't commit a crime. You cannot be guilty of a crime if you've committed it under the age of 10. That's the law as it stands in this country. And that means that, potentially if you kill somebody and you are 9.5, that you cannot be prosecuted for murder. And people might feel, oh my God, that's really a gasp. But you've got to draw the line somewhere. And I think the UK is one of the lowest ages of criminal responsibility in the Western world. So 10, in the Bulger case, they were just over 10. So they were, you could have prosecuted them. Under 10, you couldn't prosecute them. I say it's, does it need revisiting? I'm not entirely sure.
It's been visited a lot of times. It was visited not that long ago.
Are young people getting more? Are they learning more? Are 7-year-olds more astute than 7-year-olds in our day? Maybe. I don't know.
I think they are. I think they are. If you look at teenagers now, you look at the age of development of teenagers and, not just in terms of social environments around puberty and things, but just their understanding. When I think of like 12, 13-year-olds now compared to me as a 12, 13-year-old, It's worlds apart. There's so much more in France.
I'm sure that's true, but it probably says that you were very wide-eyed and innocent at the age of 10, 12, 13. I think we cannot... I don't think we can make that kind of judgment. I leave it to... It's one of those areas where I prefer the scientists, justice, criminologists. They need to look at this. And if they come to that view, generally, not generalizing, because we know people that are really, really... less than innocent at the age of 9. We also know that some that are really, really innocent at the age of 12. So, we look at that. We can't deal with it on a case-by-case basis, but at the same time, I would leave it to the experts to determine whether or not that law needs to change. As it currently stands, as I said, it's probably one of the lowest in the Western world.
And I suppose what's very interesting, and it was fortuitous that it occurred that way, is that Thompson and Venables were 10. Imagine if they had been 9.
I think there would have been an enormous hoo-ha. And probably an attempt to change the law retrospectively, which can't really do. But I think that's really, really troubling. I think it's important that we draw the line and think, well, there comes a stage in your life when you take responsibility. Personally, I think that 50-plus-year-old prime ministers should take responsibility for their alleged criminality. So, I think we need to look at that, but let's follow the science.
Yeah, actually, as you get older and you become more
powerful,
you become less accountable.
Isn't that strange? Yeah, but who knows? Maybe you and I can change that.
Yeah, well, we certainly try. Every week on week, we try and we have a conversation about that. And just finally, just whilst we're talking about age, what about age of consent? You've obviously looked at that in terms of criminality within sexual offences, and it's been up for discussions quite a lot of times.
I mean 16 is the age of consent for in this country. 13, if somebody is sexually assaulted and they're under the age of 13, then consent is irrelevant. That is rape regardless of how old they are. Again, we follow the science on this, whether or not it is a change, I'm not entirely sure that it does, but it's certainly one that needs to be regularly looked at, given the world we're in. I don't know if you've been paying attention to what's happening in America, where there are various laws going in Tennessee is one example, which will allow child marriage. All these people who are so rampant about and quite rightly attacking paedophilia and indecent images of children need to be looking at what's happening in certain parts of America, for example, where they're legislating to enable children to be married. It's pathetic. It's really pathetic.
I just want to explore slightly, just for our audience, to give some clarity in terms of, so under the age of 13, you cannot consent to anything at all. Between the ages of 13 and 16, you can consent. And, of course, the issues of that means that there is that area of unlawful sexual intercourse that sits between the 13 and 16, which does actually, one of the few offences that still has a statute of limitation in relation to it. But that clarity between the 13 and 16 is often a difficult position to understand that aspect of consent.
Yes, absolutely. I think we need a bit more certainty. And the reason why we have that is because teenagers experiment with sex. It's not aimed at 50-year-old men, raping 14-year-olds. It's meant at 14 and 15-year-old children experimenting with sex and that trying to avoid them being criminalized. So that's the reason why that little window is there, or the lack of clarity. We know it's clear under 13, we know it's clear over 16, and between 13 and 16 there's a little bit of give and take, and that relates specifically historically to enable young people to not criminalize young people who might be experimenting with sex, but it cannot be abused by older people, which unfortunately has happened on some occasions.
And I think it's absolutely relevant in today's world with social media. How many schools, I don't think there's probably a school in this country and worldwide that hasn't had to deal with a situation where a young boy or a young girl has taken photographs and they've ended up sharing.
Yeah, well, they all do. I mean, that's a whole new podcast. 72% of children between the ages of 12 and 16 say that they, women, girls, say they've been sent a picture of male genitalia by a boy. So it is a rampant problem, the one that we need to explore perhaps in more detail in a future podcast.
Yeah, and I think also I'd be interested to talk around pornography. I just think pornography and the impact of pornography on young children is desensitize and creates real problems because of the, and it also creates huge pressure for particularly young girls in terms of what is and isn't acceptable. And maybe we pick that up in a future podcast.
I agree. Availability of it is so much easier now with digital world than going back to where we started. Than it was in former times.
Brilliant. Nazir, as ever, you're a star. Brilliant. I love chatting with you. Thank you for our listeners. Do please keep coming back to us with anything you want to ask, or it's just simply to tell us that you think our podcast is really good. Until next week, thank you very much for listening. Do tell your friends, fear or favour, subscribe and like us. Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.